You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. J. Randy Tarabarelli returns to the show this week. He's a Kennedy family historian, and he's also written biographies of Elizabeth Taylor, Frank Sinatra, Marilyn Monroe, Beyonce, Diana Ross, Madonna, Michael Jackson, Grace Kelly, and lots more. His latest book has everything: sex, drugs, murder, suicide, politics, and Taylor Swift. It's called The Kennedy Heirs: John, Carolyn, and the New Generation, A Legacy of Tragedy and Triumph. J. Randy Tarabarelli, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
It's great to be back. How have you been?
Oh, good. Thank you for asking. So, congratulations. I believe this is your 1,000th book. That's fantastic.
Yeah, I love your introduction. It has everything in it, plus Taylor Swift. Yeah. So how can you go wrong with that?
Now, seriously, how do you write so many books? I hardly had time to finish reading your last one before your new one came out, and you had time to write it. How do you do this?
Well, you know, I usually average one book every 2 years, but in the case of the Kennedys, it's an interesting process in the sense that I draw from 20 years of research. So, for instance, when I wrote Jackie, Janet, and Lee, which came out 2 years ago, about Jackie Kennedy, her mom, and her sister, some of the people I talked to for that book had stories that I knew weren't suitable for that particular book, but would come in handy later, you know? So, in other words, I cultivate my sources, especially where the Kennedys are concerned. And many people have long histories with that family and a lot of anecdotes that are able to be utilized in other books about them. So I guess the best way to explain it is that in the Kennedy Heirs, some of the stories in the Kennedy Heirs came from research 20 years ago for my first book about the Kennedys, Jackie, Ethel, and Joan, Women of Camelot. So I guess if you've been around long enough and you continue to write about the same subject long enough, you're going to, you know, find yourself sort of inundated with history about this particular family, as I have.
And, you know, we're all fascinated by it, but do you think this is it? Is there another Kennedy book that you're going to write, or are you done with the Kennedys now?
No, I think I will never be done with the Kennedys. They mean a lot to me and a lot to our country in terms of history. But right now I'm working on a book about the Bush dynasty, and that's my next book that will be out in 2 years. And then after that, probably I'll go back to the Kennedy fold. I've always wanted to do a full-length biography of JFK, President Kennedy, and that's always been a dream of mine. So perhaps that might be down the road for me one day.
What about your own personal politics? I mean, when you're writing about, if you're going to write about Presidents Bush and President and mm-hmm. Senators Kennedy, do your own personal politics get involved?
They actually don't, and I think that's to my great advantage, in the sense that I'm not really a political writer. I think anybody who reads my books will tell you that they don't get a lot of politics. You know, they, of course, these families are in the politics business, and so it threads throughout as, you know, as their passion and their eagerness to serve and be public servants. But my books are really about family. My books are about mothers and fathers and siblings and the relationships that these people have with one another. And I like to think that even if they were not in politics, their stories would resonate, because politics doesn't always have a lot to do with their personal challenges. And I think that's why my books about the Kennedys have been so successful, because people are able to see themselves in the Kennedy experience. And that doesn't have a lot to do with politics, you know. It just has a lot more to do with humanity. So to answer your question, no, I really don't think so. I mean, I think that JFK and George Bush are on opposite sides of the spectrum in many respects, arguably, in terms of their politics. But that doesn't really impact the way that I approach them as subjects.
What about when you're writing about music or popular culture? Do you have to be a fan of Beyonce to write a giant book about her?
Yeah, well, now that's a really good question. And in that respect, yes. You know, I don't know why that is, because it kind of completely contradicts my last answer. But when it comes to music and entertainment, I have to be a fan. And, you know, because music is my first love in terms of writing. You know, my first bestseller was Call Her Miss Ross, which was about Diana Ross. And my second bestseller was Michael Jackson, The Magic and the Madness. And I've written a lot of books about musicians, Madonna included, and Beyonce, as you mentioned. And for me, I have to be a fan. There's a certain kind of immersion that goes into that kind of a book, where you know, I spend those 2 years of research really sort of immersed in the music and the art. And you don't really want to have to do that if you're not a fan, you know? I mean, it's hard. So, yeah, to answer your question, when it comes to music, I really do have to have an affinity for the subject. And I'm really so fortunate in that the people that I've written about in the music business are people that, first of all, I've known personally. Michael Jackson was a friend of mine for 40 years. I've known Diana Ross since I was 10 years old. I knew Madonna all the way back in the 1980s. You know, so, and Beyonce, you know, I interviewed Beyonce back before she was even in Destiny's Child. So I've been fortunate enough to have had personal experiences with these people, but the fact that I've been also been fans of theirs has helped a lot.
So before we talk about your new book, The Kennedy Heirs, John Carolyn and the New Generation, A Legacy of Tragedy and Triumph, Randy Tabarelli, let's follow up on a couple of those things you just mentioned. Now, there was a film about Michael Jackson, a four-hour film, in which young people accused rather graphically Michael Jackson of child molestation, which, you know, he'd been accused of course, many times during his lifetime, and he had been not charged or acquitted of any charges. So what were your thoughts about that film and about the recent developments?
Well, you know, it's a tough subject for me, but I can only say this. I was there at that time. I was with Michael and those guys when they were kids, and I've known those guys since they were kids, and I knew their families, and I was sort of, you know, I was sort of a part of that in the sense that I was there at Neverland. I didn't see anything like that. It doesn't mean it didn't happen, of course. It just means that my experience of Michael Jackson was nothing like that at all. And since Michael is somebody that I've known since I was a little kid, and he was a kid, he was 10 when I met him, I was 12, and I grew up with Michael Jackson and the family, I feel protective of him in the sense that this is somebody that I know, that I actually have history with and context with, and I think it's easier to automatically assume the worst of a person that is not somebody that you've ever touched, that you don't know personally, when you actually have a history with a person and you have memories, 40 years worth of memories. It's a lot more complicated. So for me and for people like me who actually knew Michael, who spent a lot of time with Michael, who never saw anything inappropriate, you know, all we can do in the face of this kind of terrible publicity that we've seen this last year is just hold fast to the Michael Jackson that we knew and keep our mouth shut, you know? And that's pretty much what I've done. What I've just told you is more than I've said, to be honest with you, it's more than I've said to anybody about those charges and about the documentary since it aired. I turned down all interviews about it because I don't think that there's an upside at all for a person like me to come forward and say anything. Michael's gone, and you know that he can't defend himself, and people will believe what they want to believe, and so for people like me to come forward and try to defend him, I think is just useless. So I haven't said a lot, and what I'm telling you right now is actually more than I've ever said.
Well, we appreciate that. Last year you revised your Madonna biography. You brought it up to date. Madonna's out right now with a new album, and it's pretty sensational. What are your thoughts about Madonna these days?
Well, you know, I'm proud of Madonna. You know, I think that, you know, anybody who has read my book about Madonna knows that, you know, my feelings about her have not been they've not been consistent over the years. And I think that when you read my book, you realize that we've all been on a journey with Madonna for the last, I don't know, I guess 35 years or so. And we've all felt different ways about her as she has presented herself in different ways to the public. And I remember back when I was a kid and I interviewed Madonna way back in the 1990s during her Justify My Love period, during the period of time when she did the sex book. And she was really presenting an overtly sexual image of herself. And I thought at the expense of her music. That was my opinion back then. And I did an interview with her. And then when I went to write the story, I was kind of a smart-ass kid, and I wrote, "She's everything that you think she is and less," right? and that's, you know, she was extremely upset with me. We didn't speak for 2 years, and, you know. But I say that to say that I obviously don't think that about her today, you know. And I think that, you know, when you're a biographer and you've been around as long as I have, you your audience allows you the opportunity to grow up and to change your points of view and your points of reference about the person you're writing about. Because I think that a lot of people don't really understand that a biography is as much a reflection of the biographer as it is the subject. All the stories that I tell about Madonna, Diana Ross, Michael Jackson, the Kennedys, Elizabeth Taylor, and the rest are through my own prism of experience and life. And you read, when you read these books, you really get to know me. You know, you get to know the kind of kid that I was when I was growing up in Philadelphia, you know, how my parents raised me in an Italian-American family. And I hope that you see that I'm not judgmental, I'm not critical, that as I've grown older, I have given my subjects a lot more latitude to make mistakes without me being the guy to constantly, you know, pummel them because of their bad judgment, you know? So I say that all that to tell you that my opinion of Madonna has changed so much over the years, and where I am right now, you know, I'm just at a place where I'm so grateful that we have icons like Madonna still with us, being relevant and doing amazing things. And I think that it's important that we respect and hold fast to these icons.
What do you think of her latest album?
I'm not a real fan of the latest album. You know, again, you know, but I think she's in a no-win situation, because I actually think that there's not much Madonna can do that's going to please all of us. You know, she has such a history that she's sort of being measured by. And we all have such great memories of songs of days gone by that whenever she puts an album out, I'm afraid that those of us old folks who've been around for as long as we have, who've loved her for as long as we have, you know, we measure her new material by her old material, which is so unfair, but we can't help it because she's so important in our lives. So I listened to the album, but, you know, I feel the same way about Beyonce. I mean, I was so angry about Beyonce's last couple of albums that as they were downloading onto my iTunes library, I was deleting the songs as they were being downloaded. I'd listen to a 1 minute and I'd hit delete. Listen to another minute, hit delete. You know,
I just, so you're not judgmental at all, Randy.
No, not at all, dude. But but I'm telling you this in an interview. I probably would never write this in a book. You know, right. But it's just, we're talking about my personal preferences right now, as opposed to, you know, the way that I want to write about these people historically. And personally, I just think that, you know, sometimes artists like Beyonce and Madonna, as much as we treasure them and we want to treasure them, sometimes they become a little bit self-indulgent, and they forget that they're making music for people and not just for themselves. And especially in the case of Beyonce, I have felt in the last couple of albums that, you know, she's not necessarily trying to appeal to the masses. She's kind of just, you know, appealing to, you know, a small group of fans that, you know, will buy whatever she puts out there. And I just think that I would like for her to do better. And in my thinking, her song Love on Top, which is like, I don't know, maybe 6 or 7 years ago, it's kind of the last great song Beyonce has ever recorded.
Well, you know, and I'm not saying this is true about you, Randy, but a lot of people get stuck in loving the music that they loved during a certain period in their lives, and they're unwilling to listen to, you know, like when an artist does a concert, if they're not playing their hits, if they're playing new material, the audience always gets restless. But shouldn't an artist follow their artistic muse rather than to think, oh, what will be a success? I mean, if you wanted to write a book, do you always want to write the book that's going to be the bestseller, or do you want to write the book you're most interested in?
Well, you know, I think that's a really good question, and I totally agree with you. You know, I always tell my friends, you know, don't sound old, you know. So you often hear people of a certain age say, you know, they don't make music the way they did back in the, you know, back in the 70s, or they don't make music the way they did back in the 60s. And when I was a kid and Motown was popular, you know, the people who are older than me were saying, oh, you know, they don't make music the way they did when Frank Sinatra was, you know, making records. You know, what is this Motown sound? So I totally agree with you in the sense that this is definitely generational. And I think that I still go back to the Motown school of marketing, in the sense that Motown, you know, was the sound of, you know, young America, and made songs that everybody, you know, could identify with, and produced songs that were classics. And I got to tell you, as much as I love Beyonce, has anything that she's recorded in the last 5 years, will any of those songs be remembered 25 years from now? I mean, really, truly, do you really know any of the songs on Lemonade? You know, I mean, do you actually know these songs? I mean, they're popular and they're big hits when they're out, but do most of us actually know, can we name the songs on Lemonade, and can we sing even one of them? I don't think so. You know, I don't think so.
Well, do you think that musical artists, and I think it's probably true of most, but maybe you can agree or disagree, that most musical artists have their biggest impact when they're in their 20s. And they may have long careers that last well beyond that period, but it's in their 20s that they make their great music. I mean, I guess there's some exceptions like Bob Dylan or Paul Simon or Paul McCartney. But, you know, most iconic musicians made their great work first.
Well, I have to agree with that. You know, I never thought Diana Ross would stop having hit records. I mean, I just never imagined that such a thing would be possible. And, you know, and that happened. And that happened when around the time that she turned 40. And if you think about it, Madonna really hasn't had a huge record, you know, since she turned 50. And I think that, you know, that's more of a function of our culture and the ageist way that we approach many things, in that it really doesn't matter what kind of song Diana Ross puts out today. It's not going to be a number one hit, you know, except if she is remixing one of her old classics, as she did in the last 2 years. She's had two number one dance hits by remixing, you know, two of her great songs, Upside Down and I'm Coming Out. But in terms of putting out new material, I think that I could probably say that there's just no way that she's going to have another hit record at the age of 75, you know. And I think that that's a shame because these people are still talented. I mean, look at Cher, you know. I mean, she's an amazing talent. I've written about Cher. Her last album, which was a tribute to ABBA, I believe it debuted at number one, which was amazing. But then the next week, it like practically fell off the charts. It's almost like every person in the country who loves Cher bought the album in one day, you know.
And then, but it didn't reach the 25-year-olds.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I think the more things change, the more things stay the same, you know. And, you know, we really want to hang on to our icons, and we want them to make music that resonates with us. But they, many times, especially in the case of Madonna and Beyonce, are wanting to appeal to people who aren't me, you know, who aren't us. You know, they want to appeal to a younger demographic. But, you know, I think they got to remember that younger demographic, the 25-year-old, doesn't really know who Madonna is. I mean, my niece and nephew, they're twins, they're 21 years old. You know, they don't have a clue about Madonna. You know, I dedicated my Beyonce book to my niece, came out when she was 18 years old, and I dedicated it to her, and she still hasn't read it. So... You know, so you're right. It's definitely generational. There's no doubt about it.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking tonight with J. Randy Tarabarelli. His new book is called The Kennedy Heirs, John, Carolyn, and the New Generation, A Legacy of Triumph and Tragedy. He's also the author of After Camelot and many other books about the Kennedys, as well as biographies of Beyonce, Diana Ross, and Frank Sinatra. Well, we're talking with J. Randy Tarabarelli, and he is the author of 10,000 books. And his newest one is The Kennedy Heirs, John, Carolyn, and the New Generation, A Legacy of Tragedy and Triumph. And, Randy, this book was, I mean, congratulations. I mean, what an accomplishment it is. I mean, you've really written, you know, 14 books in this book.
Thank you. I appreciate that. This was my toughest challenge. You know, there are so many characters in this book, and they're all so interesting, and there are so many characters in this generation of Kennedys. This book, The Kennedy Heirs, is about the children of the most powerful Kennedy generation, which was the JFK, Jackie, Bobby, Ethel, Ted and Joan generation. This is their children, and also includes the Shrivers and the Lawfords and the Smiths. So it's a big swing. It was a big undertaking to find a way to write about so many people and find a way to make to do a narrative that was involving all of them at the same time. You know, I didn't want to do a chapter on Caroline, a chapter on Ted Jr., a chapter on Patrick. That's not what I do. I needed to find a way to write about them and coming and going into each other's lives, as they really did in real history. And so, yeah, this was my biggest challenge, and I'm very happy with the way it came out, though.
Well, I think it's your best book, seriously. And it's a 600-page page-turner, which is, you know, a lot of people will look at a book that's 600 pages and think, oh, I don't think I can read that. But I read it so fast. I just tore through it. It was so interesting.
Thank you.
Who did you speak to? And I mean, you were telling us earlier that a lot of this is based on research that you've been doing for many, many years. But who all did you talk to when you were putting this book together?
Well, there are so many Kennedys I spoke to over the course of the last 20 years whose stories I was able to tell in this book, and actually all of that material is in the source notes in the back of the book, where people can actually, you know, read where the genesis of the material, you know, comes from. And I was able to tell stories that were never told before. And that really was something I wanted to do. I wanted to introduce my readers to Kennedys that they had never heard of before. Of course, some of the Kennedys in this book are well-known names: John Kennedy Jr., you know, Caroline Kennedy, you know, Maria Shriver, whose mom was Eunice Kennedy. There are many Kennedys that we've all known and loved over the years, but there are also Kennedys that I think the public has never heard of, such as, you know, Kara Kennedy. And Kara Kennedy is Ted Kennedy's daughter, who waged a battle with lung cancer at a very, very early age.
That's an amazing story.
It's an amazing story, and thank you for saying that. I really love that story so much, and to be able to tell it for the first time and bring her to life and do her that honor, because she so deserves it. I mean, she was such an incredible person. It really meant a lot to me to be able to tell her story, and people have really felt that story a lot. I've gotten a lot of mail about that story. And also Ethel Kennedy, I think, is a revelation in this book. Before, in my book, Jackie, Ethel, and Joan. But, you know, she's had 20 years to season since then. And wow, has she ever, you know. And I think that people will have a whole new appreciation for Ethel Kennedy after reading this book. Because she's quite a figure of history as the matriarch of the story, since Rose Kennedy is now gone. And much of the mail that I'm getting about the Kennedy heirs is, ironically enough, not about one of the actual heirs. It's about Ethel Kennedy, the matriarch.
Well, she sort of pops up every five pages.
She does. And, you know, just as she does in real life. I mean, I think if you're a Kennedy, she pops up in your life about every five pages.
Well, tell me a little bit about, so Bobby's kids, he had like 17 kids or 27 kids. How many kids did Bobby Kennedy have?
Oh, man, I don't know. I'd have to go back and read my book and figure that out. You know, I have to really think about that. Because there are quite a few. I mean, I ran into somebody at Starbucks this morning who said, you know, why didn't you put a family tree in the book? Because some people had trouble following all the characters, you know. And we toyed with the idea of that, but we ran out of time because the Kennedy Library, the JFK Library, sent us over a family tree that was full of mistakes. I was like, well, you've got to be the margin for error when you've got a family where everybody's named Michael, you know, and everybody's named Bobby. There are Bobbies and Michaels all over the place. And Chris's, you know, there's cousins named Chris, siblings named Chris. I mean, there are so many Christophers. You know, that I felt like I needed more time to really fine tune the family tree, and I think that will help in the paperback edition when we finally finish the family tree that we just didn't finish in time for the hardcover.
There are a lot of beautiful photographs in the book, including the cover photograph is really an amazing picture. How did you do your photographic research?
Well, thank you for asking, because I had taken part in a CNN docuseries on the Kennedys about a year and a half ago. And it was an incredible experience because I was on the air with a lot of the Kennedys that I was writing about in the Kennedy Heirs at that exact same time. And after I appeared on the documentary, it was 8 episodes every week on CNN, that really opened up the floodgates for a lot of Kennedys and also the Kennedy Library to want to provide us with photographs that had never been seen before. And the Kennedy Library gave me some really spectacular pictures that are in this book that were never published before of JFK and his kids and of Jackie and many of the other Kennedys. And so what I tried to do with the photo spread in this book was make sure that, first of all, everybody in the book is represented. But also, I wanted to make sure that the photographs were not pictures that you could just do a Google image search on and they would pop up. you know, I wanted to make sure that my readers were getting pictures that were special and unique and had never been seen before. And it took a while because, you know, I don't know every picture of the Kennedys that's ever been published, so it's not as if I could just automatically look at a picture and know for sure. So we had to do a lot of research to make sure that the pictures were one of a kind. So I appreciate that you noticed that.
I'm Gary Shapiro. You're listening to From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and tonight we're talking with J. Randy Taraborelli. He's the New York Times bestselling author of The Kennedy Heirs, John, Carolyn, and the New Generation, A Legacy of Triumph and Tragedy. There's a lot of talk about the Kennedy curse, and there does seem to be, I mean, I think people would think as they read this book, you know, although we admire the Kennedys, we definitely don't want to be one. I was thinking about Maria Shriver. She had kind of, I feel bad for her.
Well, that's interesting. If the book could make you feel, I love the fact that you feel anything, you know. I mean, I mean that's what these books are about, you know. It's about touching people with their stories. And sometimes, you know, it's easy to, you know, sort of gloss over heartache and pain, and I try not to do that. And I think Maria's story is really interesting, you know, because we all know what happened with Maria Shriver and her husband, Arnold Schwarzenegger. We all know about, you know, Arnold's relationship with the maid that produced a child, and that basically ended Maria's marriage to Arnold. But what we don't know, and what I really wanted to write about in this book, was the kind of family that Maria Shriver came from, and how she really didn't have the coping skills in place to deal with the unfaithful husband. Many people felt like because she was a Kennedy, her mom is a Kennedy, you know, that the Kennedy women have this sort of default where they know what to do, you know, because many Kennedy women have faced the same challenges over the years with the unfaithful husband. But in the case of Maria, her mom, Eunice, and her father, Sargent, had a marriage that was, I don't remember how many years, but more than 50. And Sargent Shriver was a great man I met a couple of times in my life, who would never cheat on Eunice. So it's not as if Maria had anything in her history that would have helped her deal with the unfaithful husband. And I think that the reason I'm saying this now, and the reason I wanted to write about that in the book, is because it's easy to assume that people have what they need to get through this life just by virtue of their last names. And you think, okay, she's a Kennedy, but her mom is a Kennedy, so she's a Kennedy. Of course, she would know how to deal with it, and she really didn't, you know. But I love the way that she figured it out. And I also think an important moment in the book is when the housekeeper, whose name is Mildred, confesses to Maria that, yes, Maria's suspicions were true, that this child that the housekeeper had was fathered by Arnold. And this woman becomes so overwhelmed that she falls to her knees and begins to cry. And Maria lifts her up back to her feet and tells her she should never be on her knees. And she comforts this woman. And as I wrote in the book, you know, what kind of a person is it who is able to do that, to comfort a woman who had a child, you know, with her husband? And it's one thing to be taught to be compassionate and forgiving in a household. It's another thing to actually live the experience. So I have a lot of respect for Maria Shriver. I think she's incredible. And I think that hopefully people will feel that when they read the book.
And this sort of irony of her giving up her career because she was in show business in the sense as a news reporter.
Yeah.
And she wanted to marry somebody who wasn't a politician, and then look what happened.
Well, isn't that something? I mean, I love what Eunice Kennedy says to her in the book. You know, if you want to make God laugh, tell him your plans, right? Because Maria had her life pretty much laid out in her mind. You know, she didn't want a husband who was a politician. The reason is it's long and convoluted and a little bit complicated, but in a nutshell, you know, Sergeant Shriver, Maria's father, was never really afforded the kind of respect in the Kennedy family that he deserved. There was a certain pecking order in place, and it had to do with first JFK, then Bobby, then Ted. And when Ted never became president, it sort of laid ruin to anybody else's plans in the family to do the same. And Sergeant never really was able to achieve what he should have achieved, many people might argue, because he was such a great man. And Maria was affected by that. And she never wanted to be in politics ever again. And she certainly didn't want to marry anybody in politics. And so she went as far away from the political spectrum as she could imagine. She married a bodybuilder actor, Arnold Schwarzenegger, who was a Republican, not even a Democrat, you know? So she thought that she had sort of escaped unscathed, you know, from the dynasty. But as I wrote in the book, Sergeant Shriver, her father, saw something in Arnold Schwarzenegger that he felt was very interesting. He felt that Arnold was more than an actor, that he was a public servant, and that he could contribute. And the Kennedys, of course, are all about giving back, and what can you do to give back? And Sergeant Shriver encouraged Arnold Schwarzenegger into politics, much to Maria's dismay. And her own father encouraged her husband to be a politician. And when Arnold Schwarzenegger became governor, Maria then had to give up her career because she was an NBC newscaster and host. And the network felt that, you know, how could she continue to do this as First Lady of California? The objectivity was, they felt, never going to be there again. And so she had to give up her job that she loved. And she did give it up, and it was hard for her to do that. And she did it for her husband, and she did it also because she had no choice. Right. And so I wrote that. I think it's an interesting story. It's a story about, you know, what do you do when the best laid plans, you know, go awry, as they often do. And she really became an amazing First Lady of California, and I think she has an incredible story.
And she's been on television, so she could run for president. She could be the next.
Well, hell, you know, why not? You know, I mean, you know, she was on television, so yeah, she's qualified.
Well, that's kind of another ironic story, which was when Carolyn Kennedy decided to explore the idea of becoming a senator. You know, a lot of the criticism was that she was unqualified. Well, I don't think that matters anymore, right?
Well, you know, it's a different time and place, but, you know, I also think that what we're seeing right now is an anomaly in history. I don't think that we can assume that because, you know, Donald Trump became president that now from this point on you are going to be able to sail through without having any experience. You know, I just think that he's a special case in time and place, and that there are, you know, specific reasons for, for his presidency that we may never see again. You know, it's hard to say, but I think we may never see anything like this again. In the case of Caroline, you know, yeah, she threw her hat in the ring. She is a person, Caroline Kennedy, who has been told from the time that she was a kid that she must find a way to serve. And when she turned 50, she still hadn't served, and she wanted to do something. And she was sort of facing a midlife crisis and decided to throw her hat in the ring for Hillary Clinton's seat in the Senate. And a lot of people, as I wrote in the book, you know, felt that she just wasn't qualified for it. And it was kind of comparable to, you know, asking Jackie Kennedy to run for office. You know, I mean, it just wasn't going to happen. And Ethel Kennedy in the book was not supportive of, you know, Caroline's venture into politics because she just didn't think that she was ready yet. And as it turns out, she was absolutely right. It only lasted 7 weeks, you know, this time in Caroline's life, but those 7 weeks were not happy for her at all, and she bowed out. Eventually, she did find a way to serve. As we all know, she became ambassador to Japan, and she was able to serve in that way, which was a completely different way of serving, because she wasn't she didn't have to deal with the kind of paparazzi-driven sensational headlines that you often get in New York, in the New York papers. she was far enough away from this country to be able to serve in her own way. And so her story does have what I think is a happy arc.
Well, I couldn't help but think that gender might have played a role. I mean, if John Kennedy Jr. had not been killed in a plane crash and he had thrown his hat into the ring, everybody would have said, oh, goody, let's have him.
Well, I agree with you, but I'm not sure in this particular case that it's gender influence as much as it's personality and character influence. You know, as I wrote in the book, Caroline and John were so different. You know, Caroline is a very private, sort of insulated person. John was a very open and accessible person. And John's friends told me that, you know, that there wasn't a lot about John that they didn't know, because John was very open about everything that was going on in his life. Whereas Caroline is very, very private, and it's hard to break that shell. You know, she's a very private person. You can't be a very private person and be in politics. You know, just especially today. You know, your life is laid bare, and you have to be able to answer questions about personal matters without flinching. You just have to be able to do it. It's the way it is. And Caroline was just not able to. There's a story in the book about an interview that she had with the New York Times, you know, in which she just, you know, she was short with them and argumentative and difficult. And the writer sort of lashed out at her by publishing a Q&A that was verbatim, word for word, and just did not present her in the best possible light. And they would not have done that if they weren't out to get her, you know?
They could have edited the like ums out of it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because she said like maybe, I don't know, 50 times or something, and they included each one, you know? I mean, if they wanted to give her a fair break, they could have. But if she wanted to get a fair break, she had to comport herself in a different way. And she wasn't able to do that. And, you know, you've got to be able to do that. And if you want to be in politics, and you have to be open, but you also have to be friendly, and you can't be chilly, and you can't expect to be private. And she was expecting all those things, and it just wasn't there for her. It wasn't in the cards.
She's the Barry Bonds of the Kennedys.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we've just made a tiny little dent in this book. It's an amazing book. It's called The Kennedy Heirs, John, Carolyn, and the New Generation, A Legacy of Tragedy and Triumph. And the author, the New York Times bestselling author of Jackie, Janet, and Lee, and many, many other books, my guest, J. Randy Tarabarelli. Randy, thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
It's always great to be on your show. Thank you for having me.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.